The Professor by Charlotte Bronte. Chapter 3. I served Edward as his second clerk faithfully, punctually, diligently. What was given me to do, I had the power and the determination to do well. Mr. Crimsworth watched sharply for defects, but found none. He set Timothy Staton, his favorite and head man, to watch also. Tim was baffled. I was exact as himself and quicker. Mr. Crimsworth made inquiries as to how I lived, whether I got into debt. No. My accounts with my landlady were always straight. I had hired small lodgings, which I contrived to pay for out of a slender fund, the accumulated savings of my Eton pocket money, whereas it had ever been abhorrent to my nature to ask pecuniary assistance. I had early acquired habits of self-denying economy, husbanding my monthly allowance with anxious care in order to obviate the danger of being forced in some moment of future exigency to beg additional aid. I remember many called me miser at the time, and I used to couple the reproach with this consolation: better to be misunderstood now than repulsed hereafter. At this day I had my reward. I had had it before when, on parting with my irritated uncles, one of them threw down on the table before me a 5-pound note, which I was able to leave there, saying that my travelling expenses were already provided for. Mr. Crimsworth employed Tim to find out whether my landlady had any complaint to make on the score of my morals. She answered that she believed I was a very religious man, and asked Tim in her turn if he thought I had any intention of going into the church some day, for, she said, she had had young curates to lodge in her house who were nothing equal to me for steadiness and quietness. Tim was a religious man himself. Indeed, he was a joined Methodist, which did not, be it understood, prevent him from being at the same time an engrained rascal, and he came away much posed at hearing this account of my piety. Having imparted it to Mr. Crimsworth, that gentleman, who himself frequented no place of worship and owned no god but Mammon, turned the information into a weapon of attack against the equitability of my temper. He commenced a series of covert sneers, of which I did not at first perceive the drift, till my landlady happened to relate the conversation she had had with Mr. Staton. This then enlightened me. Afterwards I came to the counting-house prepared, and managed to receive the mill-owner's blasphemous sarcasms, when next levelled at me, on a buckler of impenetrable indifference. Ere long he tired of wasting his ammunition on a statue, but he did not throw away the shafts. He only kept them quiet in his quiver. Once during my clerkship I had an invitation to Crimsworth Hall. It was on the occasion of a large party given in honour of the master's birthday. He had always been accustomed to invite his clerks on similar anniversaries, and could not well pass me over. I was, however, kept strictly in the background. Mrs. Crimsworth, elegantly dressed in satin and lace, blooming in youth and health, vouchsafed me no more notice than was expressed by a distant move. Crimsworth, of course, never spoke to me. I was introduced to none of the band of young ladies who, enveloped in silvery clouds of white gauze and muslin, sat in array against me on the opposite side of a long and large room. In fact, I was fairly isolated, and could but contemplate the shining ones from afar, and when weary of such a dazzling scene, turned for a change to the consideration of the carpet pattern. Mr. Crimsworth, standing on the rug, his elbow supported by the marble mantelpiece, and about him a group of very pretty girls with whom he conversed gaily, Mr. Crimsworth, thus placed, glanced at me. I looked weary, solitary, kept down like some desolate tutor or governess. He was satisfied. Dancing began. I should have liked well enough to be introduced to some pleasing and intelligent girl, and to have freedom and opportunity to show that I could both feel and communicate the pleasure of social intercourse, that I was not, in short, a block or a piece of furniture, but an acting, thinking, sentient man. Many smiling faces and graceful figures glided past me, but the smiles were lavished on other eyes, the figures sustained by other hands than mine. I turned away, tantalized, left the dancers, and wandered into the oak-paneled dining-room. No fibre of sympathy united me to any living thing in this house. I looked for, and found my mother's picture. I took a wax taper from a stand and held it up. I gazed long, earnestly. My heart grew to the image. My mother, I perceived, had bequeathed to me much of her features and countenance, her forehead, her eyes, her complexion. No regular beauty pleases egotistical human beings so much as a softened and refined likeness of themselves. For this reason, fathers regard with complacency the lineaments of their daughters' faces, where frequently their own similitude is found flatteringly associated with softness of hue and delicacy of outline. I was just wondering how that picture, to me so interesting, would strike an impartial spectator when a voice close behind me pronounced the words, "Humph! There's some sense in that face." I turned. At my elbow stood a tall man, young, though probably 5 or 6 years older than I, in other respects of an appearance, the opposite to commonplace. Though just now, as I am not disposed to paint his portrait in detail, the reader must be content with the silhouette I have just thrown off. It was all I myself saw of him for the moment. I did not investigate the color of his eyebrows, nor of his eyes either. I saw his stature and the outline of his shape. I saw, too, his fastidious-looking retrousse nose. These observations, few in number and general in character, the last excepted, sufficed, for they enabled me to recognize him. "Good evening, Mr. Hunson," muttered I with a bow, and then, like a shy noodle as I was, I began moving away. And why? Simply because Mr. Hunson was a manufacturer and a mill owner, and I was only a clerk, and my instinct propelled me from my superior? I had frequently seen Hunston in Bigben Close, where he came almost weekly to transact business with Mr. Crimsworth, but I had never spoken to him, nor he to me, and I owed him a sort of involuntary grudge, because he had more than once been the tacit witness of insults offered by Edward to me. I had the conviction that he could only regard me as a poor-spirited slave, wherefore I now went about to shun his presence and eschew his conversation. "Where are you going?" asked he, as I edged off sideways. I had already noticed that Mr. Hunson indulged in abrupt forms of speech, and I, perversely, said to myself, "He thinks he may speak as he likes to a poor clerk, but my mood is not perhaps so supple as he deems it, and his rough freedom pleases me not at all." I made some slight reply, rather indifferent than courteous, and continued to move away. He coolly planted himself in my path. "Stay here a while," said he. "It is so hot in the dancing-room. Besides, you don't dance. You have not had a partner tonight." He was right, and as he spoke, neither his look, tone, nor manner displeased me. My amour propre was propitiated. He had not addressed me out of condescension, but because, having repaired to the cool dining-room for refreshment, he now wanted someone to talk to by way of temporary amusement. I hate to be condescended to, but I like well enough to oblige. I stayed. "That is a good picture," he continued, recurring to the portrait. "Do you consider the face pretty?" I asked. "Pretty? No. How can it be pretty with sunk eyes and hollow cheeks? But it is peculiar. It seems to think. You could have a talk with that woman, if she were alive, on other subjects than dress, visiting, and compliments." I agreed with him, but did not say so. He went on. "Not that I admire a head of that sort. It wants character and force. There's too much of the sensitive," so he articulated it, curling his lip at the same time, "in that mouth. Besides, there is aristocrat written on the brow and defined in the figure. I hate your aristocrats." "You think, then, Mr. Hunson, that patrician descent may be read in a distinctive cast of form and features?" "Patrician descent be hanged. Who doubts that your lordlings may have their distinctive cast of form and features as much as we shire tradesmen have ours? But which is the best?" "Not theirs, assuredly. As to their women, it is a little different. They cultivate beauty from childhood upwards, and may, by care and training, attain to a certain degree of excellence in that point, just like the Oriental odalisques. Yet even this superiority is doubtful. Compare the figure in that frame with Mrs. Edward Crimsworth. Which is the finer animal?" I replied quietly, "Compare yourself and Mr. Edward Crimsworth, Mr. Hunson." Crimsworth is better filled up than I am. I know, besides, he has a straight nose, arched eyebrows, and all that, but these advantages, if they are advantages, he did not inherit from his mother, the patrician, but from his father, old Crimsworth, who, my father says, was as veritable a shireman, blue dyer, as ever put indigo in a vat, yet withal the handsomest man in the three ridings. It is you, William, who are the aristocrat of your family, and you are not as fine a fellow as your plebeian brother by long chalk." There was something in Mr. Hunson's point-blank mode of speech which rather pleased me than otherwise, because it set me at my ease. I continued the conversation with a degree of interest. "How do you happen to know that I am Mr. Crimsworth's brother? I thought you and everybody else looked upon me only in the light of a poor clerk." "Well, and so we do. And what are you but a poor clerk? You do Crimsworth's work, and he gives you wages. Shabby wages they are, too." I was silent. Hunsdon's language now bordered on the impertinent. Still, his manner did not offend me in the least. It only piqued my curiosity. I wanted him to go on, which he did in a little while. "This world is an absurd one," said he. "Why so, Mr. Hunsdon?" "I wonder you should ask. You are yourself a strong proof of the absurdity I allude to." I was determined he should explain himself of his own accord without my pressing him so to do, so I resumed my silence. "Is it your intention to become a tradesman?" he inquired presently. "It was my serious intention 3 months ago."
"Humph! The more fool you. You look like a tradesman. What a practical, business-like face you have."
"My face is as the Lord made it, Mr. Hunsdon."
"The Lord never made either ear, face, or head for town. What good can your bumps of ideality, comparison, self-esteem, conscientiousness do you here? But if you like Bigman clothes, stay there. It's your own affair, not mine."
"Perhaps I have no choice."
"Well, I care not about it. It will make little difference to me what you do or where you go. But I'm cool now. I want to dance again, and I see such a fine girl sitting in the corner of the sofa there by her mama. See if I don't get her for a partner in a jiffy. There's Waddy. Sam Waddy making up to her. Won't I cut him out?"
And Mr. Hunson strode away. I watched him through the open folding doors. He outstripped Waddy, applied for the hand of the fine girl, and led her off triumphant. She was a tall, well-made, full-formed, dashingly dressed young woman, much in the style of Mrs. E. Crimsworth's. Hunsdon whirled her through the waltz with spirit. He kept at her side during the remainder of the evening, and I read in her animated and gratified countenance that he succeeded in making himself perfectly agreeable. The mama, too, a stout person in a turban, Mrs. Lupton by name, looked well pleased. Prophetic visions probably flattered her inward eye. The Hunsdons were of an old stem, and scornful as York, such was my late interlocutor's name, professed to be of the advantages of birth. In his secret heart he well knew and fully appreciated the distinction his ancient, if not high lineage, conferred on him in a mushroom place like this shire, concerning whose inhabitants it was proverbially said that not one in a thousand knew his own grandfather. Moreover, the Hunsdons, once rich, were still independent, and report affirmed that York bade fair, by his success in business, to restore to pristine prosperity the partially decayed fortunes of his house. These circumstances considered, Mrs. Lupton's broad face might well wear a smile of complacency as she contemplated the heir of Hunsdon Wood occupied in paying assiduous court to her darling Sarah Martha. I, however, whose observations being less anxious, were likely to be more accurate, soon saw that the grounds for maternal self-congratulation were slight indeed. The gentleman appeared to me much more desirous of making than susceptible of receiving an impression. I know not what it was in Mr. Hunsdon that, as I watched him, I had nothing better to do, suggested to me, every now and then, the idea of a foreigner. In form and features he might be pronounced English, though even there one caught a dash of something Gallic. But he had no English shyness. He had learnt somewhere, somehow, the art of setting himself quite at his ease and of allowing no insular timidity to intervene as a barrier between him and his convenience or pleasure. Refinement he did not affect, yet vulgar he could not be called. He was not odd, no quiz, yet he resembled no one else as I had ever seen before. His general bearing intimated complete, sovereign satisfaction with himself, yet at times an indescribable shade passed like an eclipse over his countenance and seemed to me like the sign of a sudden and strong inward doubt of himself, his words and actions, an energetic discontent at his life or his social position, his future prospects or his mental attainments, I know not which. Perhaps, after all, it might only be a bilious caprice. The end of chapter 3. Read by Rick Kistner. For Lit to Go on the web at FCIT
www.usf.edu.